Welcome to the Pain Science Division podcast series. My name is Judy Hunter, and our guest today is Dr. Kathleen Sluka, who's a professor of physical therapy and rehab science at the University of Iowa. She's a physical therapist and a neuroscientist, and her lab is called the Neurobiology of Pain Lab, and it's a translational research laboratory, meaning she looks at a question not only in humans and in clinical work, but also in an animal model as well, and translates back and forth between those two models. And she's published over 150 peer-reviewed manuscripts and has received numerous awards. And she has a wonderful textbook out, Pain Mechanisms and Management for the Physical Therapist, which is on the basics of pain neurobiology. But in addition to her academic work, she's an advocate for improved guidelines and interprofessional pain education. Today I'm interested in talking to her about her recent work, which looks at exercise and pain, and specifically the contrast that regular physical activity can relieve pain and prevent and reduce pain, but also activity in the sedentary individual with pain can actually exacerbate pain and make pain worse. And she's looked at the underlying mechanisms for that, and I want to ask her more about that today. So welcome, Dr. Sluka.
Thank you, Judy. So based on the research and based on what's been published, there's several key points, I think, and as we get through this podcast, some of the underlying biology of why that is will hopefully address. The first key point is that if for people with chronic pain, you need to get them to do activity of some sort. But the type of activity is less important than the actual physical activity that they do. So every time a research study has tested two different exercise programs against another exercise program, they're both effective. And one does not seem to be superior to the other. So to improve compliance and participation from the subject, you need to make it individualized to the person and what they will actually do. The other key issue is we don't really know dosing yet. How much is the minimal dose? From some animal studies we've done, it seems that the dose doesn't have to be that high. A few days of physical activity is enough to prevent the development of chronic pain in an animal model. The effects don't last forever, so you can't exercise for a week and then expect to last for a month. It needs to be continuous. We kind of already know this, but I think it's something that we need to point out again, and we need to point out to our subjects that this is a continual event. And that's because there's neurotransmitters and neuroreceptors in the central nervous system that are continually released in response to exercise that modify our neuronal response to pain.
So that's interesting. You say for people with chronic pain, it's important to work individually with them in order to find a physical activity they enjoy and will do often. That's the most important aspect of it. And getting them moving and the repetition of that activity is important. But we've all worked with individuals in whom exercise hurts. For example, when we're initially working with individuals with fibromyalgia or complex regional pain syndrome. Can you describe your findings? I find them very interesting, about why exercise hurts in these individuals and how we can use this knowledge to get the person moving.
Right, so we've done a couple of studies. We've done some in people with fibromyalgia to see how much their pain really does go up during an exercise task. So we've taken people with fibromyalgia, we've put them through a 12-minute fatiguing exercise task of the upper extremities, and it's a whole body exercise using the Valpar, and we get increases in pain of 3 points on a VAS. So their pain may start at a 5, by the time they're done with that task, it's gone up to an 8. That's telling me that's a substantial problem. We're taking people from moderate to severe pain. So we developed some animal models to really look at the underlying mechanisms for why we're getting that increase in pain, with the hopes that then we can treat the mechanisms for the increase in pain. So we've shown that fatigue metabolites, things like ATP, decreases in pH, and lactate are released during fatiguing exercise. Some of this we already know, and we've shown it also in our animal models. And then if we combine that with a muscle insult, we get an enhanced and long-lasting hyperalgesic response. So we're getting a long-lasting hyperalgesia in response to combining fatigue with a muscle insult.
So by hyperalgesia response, can you describe that for the listeners a little?
Oh, certainly. Sorry. So hyperalgesia is an increased response to a noxious stimuli. So in animals, we can't directly ask them whether or not they have pain. So we measure their response to applying noxious stimuli to the periphery. And in general, we're looking for a decrease in threshold. And that's our measure of pain in an animal model. So we in our animal models, we look at a decrease to deep tissue pressure over the muscle.
So it's a deep tissue hyperalgesia, not a
absolutely. Well, there is a cutaneous component as well in most of these models. So it's more of a widespread hyperalgesic response.
So with exercise that fatigues, the metabolites cause pain, activate nociceptors, and when that muscle's injured, it causes a more long-lasting activation, so I guess sensitization and hyperalgesia. That sounds like a local effect with the ASIC and the ATP receptors, but can you explain the role of the immune system here?
So the second thing we've determined is So these fatigue metabolites are released. They activate nociceptors and through specific channels like the acid-sensing ion channel or an ATP receptor, and that produces the pain that the people are feeling. We've also recently discovered that in addition to that, that in physically inactive individuals, we have a more inflammatory immune system, so that within the muscle there's macrophages that sit there. These macrophages sit there in a state in which they release inflammatory cytokines. And inflammatory cytokines produce pain by themselves. When the fatigue metabolites are released, our ATP and our decreases in pH, they actually activate the macrophages directly, which subsequently release the inflammatory cytokines to produce the pain response. What happens with regular exercise is that these macrophages change their phenotype. They change what they produce. They turn into anti-inflammatory cytokine producers. So they go from what we call an M1, which is an inflammatory macrophage, to an M2, which is an anti-inflammatory macrophage. And when anti-inflammatory cytokines are released, they actually produce analgesia. So they release things like IL-10 or IL-4. And so our animal models have shown that if you're sedentary, you have more of this inflammation state, that with regular physical activity, just being active or exercise on a treadmill or being active in a running wheel on a regular basis, switches those to produce more anti-inflammatory cytokines and actually protects us against the chronic pain that the animals are feeling. So we're seeing a change in the immune state based upon how active the animal is. We're doing the same experiment right now in human subjects who are physically active and physically inactive that have fibromyalgia and in healthy controls, to try and translate that back to the clinical situation. And it's very preliminary now, so we don't have all the details, but it seems like that same scenario is happening in human subjects as well.
So someone who has been inactive, maybe because of their pain or their fibromyalgia, the early stages of exercise could be more inflammatory, you're saying, in the muscle and the soft tissue in the periphery?
Yes.
And what about, does it involve central sensitization too? Or are you saying this is
Yes, it does. So I think the thing about exercise is there's multiple mechanisms that are underlying its analgesic effect. We've also done a series of studies looking at the central nervous system and its response to regular physical activity. So in pathways involved in central inhibition, we see a change in the state of the neurons, that in sedentary animals, that the neurons are more easily activated. We measured this by looking at markers of excitatory neurotransmitters, and we show that there's an increase in phosphorylation of, say, an NMDA receptor, which would suggest more excitability in the neuron. In sedentary animals, they get a muscle insult, or with an acute bout of exercise in a sedentary animal. And in animals that are physically active, these increases don't occur. So we change the state of the neuron, and we change the ability to activate central excitability by just being physically active.
How, you said you've started to do clinical trials, but how could we start to translate this? Is this the idea of start low and go slow sort of approach to physical exercise?
Absolutely. So I think that's probably the key to exercise in an individual with chronic pain. Every patient will tell you that the exercise increases their pain, and they can't do it because it increases their pain. So one of the ways that you can alleviate that is to think about reducing the amount of activity you're giving to the central nervous system, either by reducing the amount of fatigue, so they aren't fatiguing quite as much, or reducing how much input is going into those central neurons to cause excitability. So starting slowly, increasing slowly, an individual without chronic pain, and targeting them, and maybe even doing it in a graded manner so that with the understanding that there will be some increases in pain, but those increases shouldn't last for hours or days, that maybe they're going to last for during the pain, maybe they'll last for an hour or two afterwards, and have people titrate their exercises and slowly increase them. And this is key. I think you see in fibromyalgia patients all the time that you know you have to go more slowly with them, but I think it's also important for other chronic pain conditions that have responded in an amplified manner.
You've talked about the role of, I'm thinking again with this starting low and going slow, you talked about the role of fatigue, but there's a tendency to have patients with fibromyalgia start in the water, in warm water, and yet there's some literature that says it doesn't make much difference whether it's dry land exercise or water exercise. It's a little bit of a debate. Do you think there's a role for fatigue in that water exercise? Would you say that?
Sure. There's a role anytime you exercise that if you're exercising at a significant level, you will fatigue. And someone with fibromyalgia is incredibly deconditioned. Their their level of activity is below that in general of those that are sedentary, normal individuals. So you need to be careful about asking them to do an activity. What you think is not that stressful may be incredibly fatiguing to their muscles because they just haven't done as much and their muscles aren't accommodating well to that. And so I think this goes back to, like you said, there's multiple types of exercise that work. The warm water is sometimes useful because it gives people a little bit of pain relief while they're exercising. Mm-hmm. But whatever the person is willing to do is what you need to do with them and get them to buy into a program. The other thing you may do, again, with the start slowly is not have them exercise daily, but have them do something every other day. Give them the ability to have a day off and then go back the next day and do it. Mm-hmm. There's not much data on dose, but most of the trials that have been done don't have people exercise 7 days a week. They have them do 2 or 3 times a week. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking in terms of try to give people manageable goals and manageable treatment plans that they can buy into, and having someone do 7 days a week. I don't exercise 7 days a week, and I don't think most people do. So thinking about what they can do and what and be on a regular basis. The other thing you can think about is having them just slowly increase their number of steps per day, for example. Just increase their activity levels. Park, you know, a little bit farther away when you go to work or to go to the grocery store and take those few extra steps. It's a small increase in activity on a regular basis, and regular physical activity is equally important to putting them on an exercise program, and that might be an easier way to get people to incorporate an active lifestyle within a day-to-day basis.
Thank you. And I know one of the things you strongly support is self-management and giving a person control, having them feel control of their pain and understand how to manage activity themselves. And many patients, when they have this initial increase in pain intensity when first starting exercise, how can you advise them to take control of their flare-ups so that compliance isn't undermined?
So the flare-ups are really important. So first of all, they need to be aware of them, how long they last, what triggered them, and get them to learn from that flare-up how not to do quite as much the next time. You know, if you're having a really good day, and you hear this all the time as well, people go and do the laundry and clean the house and do everything, and they overdo it. So they need to learn how to pace themselves better. And so if you have a flare-up, use it as a learning experience, not as a negative experience. And then also let them know that it's okay to take some ibuprofen to reduce some of the pain, or to go use some heat or a TENS unit, which we'll talk about in more detail later. But maybe you need to give them some pain-relieving methods that will reduce the pain either during their exercise or afterwards, so that it's not as severe an event. Also, education is really important. They need to understand that it may hurt a little bit more for the first couple weeks until some of that biology kicks in, until we turn the immune system to an anti-inflammatory state from an inflammatory state, or change the state of the neurons. It might take a week or two before it starts to become more analgesic and less painful.
And that leads me right into my TENS question, because you think of TENS as a passive strategy, and we're talking about active strategy, and yet you've talked about how TENS might play a role in the patient taking control of their pain and trying to increase exercise. Can you explain the role TENS might play in trying to increase activity?
So as you know, I've spent a lot of years trying to figure out how it is that TENS produces its analgesia. And we've come up with a number of mechanisms based on frequency and intensity. So that low frequency, we know, activates mu opioid receptors in the central nervous system, and high frequency activates delta opioid receptors in the central nervous system. We know that intensity is critical to effectiveness, so you have to increase it high enough to have an effective treatment. If it's not high enough, it doesn't work.
And how high, can you explain the intensity setting? What do you mean high enough?
So we've done some dose response curves, and we've done some studies in human subjects. And what we've come to is it needs to be at a strong sensory intensity or higher. What we've gone to in our clinical trials now is that to have them turn it up as high as they can tolerate. And so a high frequency might be causing a muscle contraction. So a conventional TENS with a muscle contraction is okay. And a low frequency might also be causing a muscle contraction. But we want it up as high as they can tolerate, but it's still comfortable. So we're looking at a very strong but comfortable intensity. In our dose response curves, we show a very linear dose response curve based on intensity. So the low sensory threshold produces virtually nothing. If you go above sensory threshold to a strong but comfortable, you get a significantly increased amount of analgesia. And it turns out that the more you can get them to turn it up, the better off they are for the amount of analgesia that they get. And that's probably because we're releasing more neurotransmitters. We're activating more pathways. More neurotransmitters are released in the central nervous system, and we're getting to the deeper tissues with the higher intensity. So we have done a study that shows that deep tissue afferents are critical for the analgesia produced by TENS. Cutaneous afferents don't play a role in that analgesia. We've anesthetized the skin, and analgesia still occurs, and if you anesthetize the deep tissue, all the analgesia goes away. So you need to get a high enough intensity in order to get to the deep tissue afferents and to activate more afferents, releasing more neurotransmitters to produce an analgesic effect.
And this is with, I'm sorry, I missed it. Is this with low frequency or high frequency or both?
It doesn't matter, both. And in fact, based on a lot of our clinical studies, we also tend to do mixed frequency TENS, where it mixes between a low and a high frequency. So we've shown that repeated application of either low or high frequency TENS will produce analgesic tolerance because it's activating opioid receptors. We know that you can get tolerance with repeated use of opioids. Well, this is the same scenario. We get tolerance with repeated TENS because it uses opioids to produce its analgesia. But if we mix the frequencies or alternate the frequencies, so either give low and high at the same time, or low on one day and high on another day, we can prevent development of analgesic tolerance. So we tend to do a lot of our more long-term studies and even recommend to clinicians that they use a mixed frequency from between a low and a high frequency TENS for individuals, and then they get a longer lasting effect of the TENS itself.
That's very interesting. How would you fit that in with patients taking control of their pain? Is this something you would have them, something you'd have them do before they exercise, after they exercise, or tie it to exercise?
All right, so that's the next. So when you talk about TENS, we recently did a kind of a preliminary clinical trial. We used 43 people with fibromyalgia and gave them a single treatment of TENS and compared it against a placebo. And what we showed in these individuals is that TENS reduced the pain during a 6-minute walk test, but did not reduce the pain at rest. So it specifically reduced the pain during movement. So to us, it makes sense to either use the TENS during their exercise or when they're physically active, as opposed to give it to them for a couple hours a day and then have them go do a bunch of things and come back and use it again. So our contention is that since it works quite well for movement pain, that they should use it during activity. The other really interesting thing from a biology standpoint we saw in that trial is we also measured their excitability by looking at pressure thresholds at the site where we gave the TENS, but we also looked at pressure thresholds outside the site in the leg. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we looked at the integrity of their inhibitory systems, what we call conditioned pain modulation. And that's where you just put somebody's hand in a ice bucket of water or noxious stimuli, and then they will have increases in analgesia across the rest of their body. And what we showed with TENS was that it not only reduced the pain right at the site or increased the pain thresholds at the site, it also did it well outside the site in the leg, showing that we could reduce kind of that widespread excitability, which we think is from central sensitization. And it also restored their inhibitory system. So in people with fibromyalgia, they have ineffective central inhibition so that they don't get a normal increase in pain when you give them a noxious stimuli. In our people with fibromyalgia, they had their central inhibition restored, so they were now getting analgesia when they had TENS on to a stimulus that they didn't to when compared to a placebo where they got no analgesia. And these were the same subjects. So we're showing that TENS can actually activate our inhibitory pathways and restore some of our inhibition and reduce some of our central excitability at the same time.
Very interesting because in the literature there's a lot more information and data and evidence around the importance of being able to recognize central sensitization, to recognize when there's more generalized sensitization that implies a lack of descending inhibition working up to its full functioning capacity, and the importance of pathways like cognitively targeted exercise and behavioral therapies that help, and calming exercises that help the individual augment this descending inhibitory control. So, are you saying TENS during exercise is one more tool that can be used to help with this?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're saying. And we have years of animal studies to show that it indeed does activate these descending inhibitory pathways in the PAG and the medulla, in the spinal cord, that it activates a number of neurotransmitters, including serotonin. And now I have evidence that that also occurs in human subjects. Exercise similarly does activate our descending inhibitory pathways. We have data that shows that exercise is also activating those same pathways and also may be doing some of its effects through increasing endogenous opioid release and may also be able to reduce some of the excitability. There's some other studies in human subjects that have translated that, showing that exercise may also reduce some central excitability in the central nervous system as well. So I think that's exactly what we do. We need to understand the mechanisms of how pain is being transmitted in our patients, how much of it is peripheral, how much of it is central. If they have a peripheral component, we should target the periphery. If they have a central component, we should target the central nervous system. Likely they have both. So we shouldn't ignore the central nervous system or the peripheral nervous system. Almost everybody has a component of both. But we should pick our treatments and our thought processes based on a mechanism-based approach as opposed to primarily just saying, well, this works in this population. But thinking more from a mechanism-based approach, I think will be more effective in our treatments. And indeed, exercise and TENS may be ways to reactivate the central nervous system.
Well, I think you just summed it up. Thank you very much. This was very interesting, and I appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. And we will now understand a little bit more about how we can translate animal research into our clinical activities. And thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you very much, Judy. This was fun.